Well, welcome everyone. We can get started in a second here, but I invited those of you who weren't here yesterday after our session or during our session, when there's time, if you want to, the white papers here and there are part of our conversation yesterday where we talked about practical, real life places in our world that need jubilee, that need restoration, healing, radical resets and recalibrations. And we talked about jubilee is an aspirational idea, so we're thinking real big when we think about some of the aspirational hopes we have for jubilee in the world around us. So feel free, as you're moved, to add to our context if there's a topic that's not been mentioned that is something important to you or something where you're seeking jubilee in the world, please add it to our collection and our context here. I'll reintroduce myself briefly. My name is Rachel Haxtema. I use she, her pronouns. I come from Tacoma, Washington, and I've studied theology and ethics, primarily focusing on social theory and ethics. And I'm most interested in kind of lived reality. What are people doing in churches to live into the values and beliefs that they claim? So I did social research on how people talk about their activism for social justice and how they live into their values and beliefs in those ways. And I teach Christian ethics from time to time at PLU, including community engagement. So what are churches and communities in our neighborhoods doing to actually live into their beliefs around what is right and what is good and what is a Christian to do? So that's where I come from. I'm most interested in that lived reality. So we'll end today's session with some stories from places where I see some opportunities for jubilee in the world and where I see people doing that, living into those values. But first we'll begin with some biblical witness, some biblical grounding for concepts around jubilee and economics, specifically looking at liberation theologies, which is primarily coming from Latin America when we think that term, but also Black liberation theology. And then, like I said, some stories from communities. And then as a potential practice that might help you going forward from this place in your own choices for living into your values, family or community meetings that you could have with your group, whatever your group might be. So we'll talk a little bit more about that at the end. So if you were here yesterday, we also and in the service and in the Holden materials, you're probably beginning to hear some of these themes come through around Sabbath and Shemitah and Jubilee being these biblical ancient Hebrew laws that declared that people should have a moment for rest, a moment for release, for the changing of the reality to shift it. And so we hear from Deuteronomy, the Sabbath day mandate and the remission of debts, the liberation of slaves every Sabbath year, that's every seventh year. And then the cycle goes every seven times seven is the Jubilee year, right? On the 50th year, it's the Jubilee year. We talked a little bit yesterday about how we're not sure if Jubilee was ever enacted in the way that we read about the law and the biblical text. We're not sure. There's some indication that some aspects may have been truly followed, but there's a lot of indications that we don't think it ever was enacted fully in the ways we imagine it could have been. Which means it's a very aspirational idea, which could continue to be an aspiration for us. I don't think the fact that it wasn't done shouldn't, you know, dissuade us from having that as an aspiration and something we look towards, right? And so you see here the text from Exodus that even this idea that you should sow your land for 6 years and the seventh let it rest was both to let the land rest and potentially a good agricultural practice, but also so that the poor of your people may eat and that the wild animals may eat. So it was also a way to allow for gleaning or other types of people to gather from the food. Again, it feels very aspirational to me that you would do this in this kind of way, that the poor could eat from the land every seventh year without sowing. I'm not exactly sure what that would look like in practice. There was some studies I read that said it would be like different people did it differently, so that every year there was a field that was fallow, which maybe makes more practical sense, but it's not... 100% clear, you know, how it was practiced, but the idea was there that in our law, there was an idea that we should take care of people and take care of the land and take care of the poor. And so that's what I'll focus on, is that idea that we should. And so then we hear in Luke that when Jesus announces his public ministry, he specifically mentions good news to the poor. And so we're going to talk a little bit more today about the biblical witness around how we are to respond to issues of poverty in our community. So throughout the ancient Hebrew laws, we have this Sabbath, Shemitah, Jubilee law with the intention that people should have access to the means of production so that they could support their families. So that meant if they fell into debt, if they fell into a hard year, they could sell part of their land, but then it would be returned to them after a time so that it wouldn't be forever and ever people getting poorer and poorer, that it would be some sort of reset every several years. But throughout the law, we also have special protections to protect potentially vulnerable people. Specifically, are always mentioned widows and orphans and elders who might fall outside of the practices of how families were supporting one another. But we also see this idea that these are not necessarily charity laws. The laws don't say you have to give something to the poor people in your community, but there's actually this giving back, right? That your family could regain your land. So it's a second chance for your family, not just a little bit here and there, like what we might think of food banks or other kinds of just giveaways here and there as charity, but really this chance for the family to start again and to really have the opportunity to provide for themselves. And then the bound laborers were released after 6 years, and sometimes that was because they or their family had a difficult year, so one person in their family was then became a bound laborer to another wealthier family, right? But the idea that there was this reset, they could always have a second chance and go back to a way to provide for themselves. And that's in the law, right? So the laws were created with these kinds of protections. What we know of and what we mentioned yesterday is like the Israelites apparently failed to follow their laws quite a bit. And so we have the whole witness of the prophetic text, right? Where the prophets come to say, you're not following the laws that have been set out before you. Return to the law, return to God, and pay attention. And so the prophets really spoke directly to the accumulation of wealth at the expense of the poor. And if you've studied Amos and Micah and Isaiah, maybe you have already heard this quite clearly or know this, but there's some very direct references to the accumulation of wealth at the expense of the poor throughout the text, but primarily in these 8th century prophets, Amos and Isaiah and some of the others. Amos and Micah, I think, are the two that have it the clearest. So the book that I'll put in the resources, there is a blue sheet to sign up for if you want an email after you leave with a set of potential resources, readings, and follow-up items. We can get you that. D.N. Premnath wrote a book called 8th Century Prophets, and it's a social analysis of that 8th century time period. So he looks really carefully using the tools of archaeology and social analysis to see what was happening when these prophets were saying these things. And he sums it up in this term, latifundialization, which I'm not even going to put there because it's a silly word that only he uses. But it's stuck with me because it's so relevant to our world. It's the accumulation of land by wealthy landowners to create export crops to make profit, right? So going from a peasant landscape where peasant farmers grow food for themselves and their families to an economic structure where the wealthy keep buying up land, keep taking it over from people who can't afford it anymore, can't afford to take care of it anymore, and grow primarily olive oil, grapes for wine, and olives for olive oil, grapes for wine, and wheat to be exported. Not for the food of the peasants, but to be exported for the wealth of the landowners. And so there's some references here, these two. You could go a very deep study of Amos specifically and Micah and some others, where these ideas, tearing down the winter house as well as the summer house and houses of ivory, right? Like these are not peasant houses. These are wealthy landowners who have accumulated extravagant wealth beyond what they need. And then the other text, you trample on the poor, take from them levies of grain, taxes. You have built up houses of hewn stone, but you do not even live in them. You have planted pleasant vineyards, but you shall not drink their wine. So really calling out that concept of you're taking advantage of peasants and you need to stop. This is not the way that this was intended. We were intended to take care of one another. So true worship is the work for justice and care for the poor and the oppressed. So the prophets are a great place to go if you're looking for strong economic justice kinds of language and direct instructions and calling people back to those laws that we have the Jubilee concept from. And then we move, we could do Bible study upon Bible study, and the Holden Audio Archives have great Bible studies around economic justice, but I'll just mention a few of the things that you're probably well aware of from the Gospels in the early church. So Mary's Magnificat, he has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. So strong cry again, for economic justice I hear in that text. And then Jesus in many places says important things about this, but one primary text that we reference a lot: I was hungry and you gave me food, I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink, a stranger and you welcomed me, naked and you gave me clothing, sick and you took care of me, in prison and you visited me. That complete call to care for one another. And then we have the witness of the early Christian communities sharing their food, their resources in common. We have stories of wealthy members of the community joining with poorer members, selling property and fields in order to participate in this life-giving new movement and new community, this new way of life. And it was pretty radical for that time and context that would happen, that people would eat together in that particular way, which is why our Eucharist celebration can be, I think, a real symbol of justice when we take that in mind, that comes from this practice of wealthy and poor people eating together at the same table and having enough. So I hope you hear that clear call for economic justice and for care for one another coming strongly throughout the Bible the way that I do. So I'd like us to spend a little bit of time in reflection. Reflection is an important part of my teaching and learning hopes for students and for communities, that we take some time to think about what this feels like for ourselves, right? What does economic liberation mean for you in your own life? What would it feel like to have a true Jubilee, to be truly liberated economically in your own experience? What words, feelings, memories come to mind as you consider what that might be like? And then specifically, who in your friends, family, community needs economic liberation? And not as much the who, I guess, but like what is causing the needs for economic liberation for the people you know? What structures or systems are people caught under? And how does that feel for your community? So maybe just take a couple minutes to consider, you know, for yourself, if you have a piece of paper to jot notes or reflect in that way. But to think for yourself, what do those texts call you towards? What do the texts and the biblical witness suggest for you? And then thinking about our communities, what systems are getting in the way of that kind of freedom feeling, that liberation feeling for people you know? So spend a couple minutes, and then maybe with a partner or a small group of two or three, share something about maybe that last question specifically, but anything you want to share with each other. And if you didn't meet the person that you're sitting with yesterday or don't know them already, please be sure to introduce yourselves and connect with each other too. Thanks. Okay, we'll come back together. I got a microphone, so then I can be loud. Thank you. So when we think about some of the situations we were discussing more in terms of what systems or structures are keeping people we know in a really difficult economic situation or just in our community, the things we notice, there are probably some of the things that are already named on our papers, but are there, do anybody want to share some of the systems or the structures that you were discussing in your small group? Yeah.
One that's a real issue is the high cost of housing.
Yeah. So high cost, difficulty finding affordable housing is certainly a really big challenge in a lot of communities right now. Yeah.
I live in Seattle, So we have Microsoft and Amazon and people living in tents on the street.
Right.
So there's no shortage of money in Seattle. So
yes.
Redistribution.
Redistribution, yeah. So that increasing everyday gap between the wealthy and the poorest.
Ivy.
Wow. I'm like, I can spell redistribution.
U-T-A-O-R. I'm her mama.
Sorry, no. Sorry. Okay. Yeah, so it's very obvious in some of our communities, some of what I see in the prophetic text, that really clear, wealthy, very poor dynamic is becoming clearer. Yeah.
You know, I think we need to also look at the fact that we're always thinking about the economic kind of issues because, you know, I lived in a village in the most northern village in the United States. And, you know, when I went there, I thought they were poor, but they were rich. They didn't have all the money but they had a rich culture. They were able to subsist. They were subsisting. And so I think it's important for us also not to put our own thoughts of what value is to others, too. And so we have to listen to what's going on, and we have to be part of that.
Yeah. And so I think what I hear, though, is that that community has been able to subsist and stay healthy or whole or on a good, stable place, where I know there's a lot of small communities that used to have that don't have that anymore. So I do think, yes, the wealth is beyond actual money wealth, right? And the ability to take care of one another in our communities is not always about financial power.
But it's social media. Yeah. When television came into the village, then the kids said, we don't have this
cultural
kind of
change.
Why should, you know, we're deprived. Yeah. They thought they were deprived. And I said, well, wait a minute, I don't think so. I don't think that you're deprived.
Yeah, and I actually saw that in Central America when I was working in Central America too, saw posters in small homes, you know, where people seemed to be subsisting okay. It wasn't perfect, but there was some good things about their community. But then I walked inside and saw posters of American movies and cars on the wall, and it was such a disconnect for me as well. But what we saw as beauty and a really interesting cultural life being influenced by that. Yeah, it's tough when that happens to communities. You had one, yeah.
I was just to piggyback on that. I was thinking about that first question, what does economic liberation mean in your life? I'm thinking about what the difference between that question is and what would wealth mean in your life.
Right.
Like, what's the difference in the relationship between economic liberation and wealth? Does one have to mean the other?
Not necessarily economic.
Probably a lot of people with wealth are not economically liberated.
Yeah, yeah.
That's true.
They need more.
Yeah.
And also to piggyback on what the gentleman said too as well, I think it's going to require a huge paradigm shift on how we think about want versus need. The whole idea about this cultural idea or societal idea about the boys having the biggest toys, the whole idea of having more means that your status is higher, that you are successful. If you can somehow shift that paradigm to more the effect of more of looking at it having enough to make you wealthy, I think I think that's what needs to change in order to have true economic liberation as it's described in the Bible. Because the fact of the matter is that everybody is hoarding all this stuff.
Right.
For what?
Yeah, so good questions. And I thought today we'll focus on the actual money issues of poverty and wealth, but you're bringing up some really important broader concepts that are connected around what wealth really means, what enough really means, yeah.
But enough also implies confidence in the system. So in our retired life, how much do we need going forward? How much confidence do we have in pension systems and so on? So I think it is tied to economics. So confidence in enough means confidence in your systems around you.
Right, and I think that connects to this idea of what is wealth and what is enough. Like, do I feel like I have enough? And then when culture tells me I don't, then we have a bigger challenge, right? Because it's the interconnection of, is it actually economically feasible and will we be okay? Plus the cultural decisions that we don't have enough. There's always a need for more and more and more. Yeah, Jeff.
So I think one of the biggest pieces is the, you know, I'm going to put it my way, but we talked about it, but the abolition of the debt system,
yeah.
Because so many of the people that I'm around, including myself,
yeah.
You know, if you're talking strictly about money, even have a negative net worth. And that's with being, you know, quote unquote, responsible with money and things like that, because to even get a basic job where you're maybe making $35,000 a year, they're asking you for a four-year degree. And so many people, especially if you're going out of a community that does not have that much money and you can't pay out of pocket, which is most college students, most young people, you are now starting out completely indebted to the government and to private companies too. And so you can't build any sort of comfort because everything is going to something.
Right. Yeah, so I saw a student loan forgiveness, student debt on some of the papers we put up for context. I know that's a heavy feeling for most people in my age range and the few generations underneath me even, maybe still for generations above me as well. But the debt system is definitely something that feels onerous to many of us. Yeah. And so we talk about, like, a lot of people will talk about healthy debt or good debt, right? And it still feels heavy to those people who feel like it's never ending and they're never going to be able to pay it off and it's just always there. This one, though, we'll talk a little bit more about, is, doesn't fall into that category usually of good or healthy debt. And when we think about what Jubilee means, all of these things kind of conflict with our understanding of Jubilee. Yeah, besides housing, general wealth distribution, debt systems, is there one, any other specific
term?
Healthcare. Yeah.
Include mental health.
Yeah. So healthcare, all the associated challenges we have with the interactions between financial and healthcare systems. We could talk a little bit more, maybe in here and here, everywhere, about the private-public kind of the privatization of a lot of our public resources, too. I think that becomes, for me, a real financial scary thing. Sorry. So thank you for doing that, and I hope that you are hearing some interesting things from one another about the things that weigh on us when we feel this need and this longing for Jubilee. And so I wanted to move us towards kind of some conversation about liberation theologies that take seriously a lot of this justice language from the biblical texts and the ideas behind that, and create these liberation theologies that move us in new directions, I think. And so liberation theologies is kind of like a summary of some of their focus areas. But they do focus theological reflection on the poor, the oppressed, the marginalized. And again, we can come back to this conversation of what does poor mean in these contexts, and who, you know, what wealth and what goodness comes in communities that don't have a lot of financial power. Certainly, that we don't want to say that they don't have good things and that they aren't good, right? Like, there's huge amounts of wealth in the people themselves. But when we think about the structures in our communities and the structures in our society that really do harm, there is a lot of oppression and marginalization in our world. And so we want to take that really seriously and look at that piece of it, right? Like, what is going on in our community, in our world, that is harming and that is pushing people into difficult situations or very harmful, violent, terrible situations as well. And so liberation theologies say we always need to look for those folks and find out what's going on for them, what is their real experience like, and then take seriously from that perspective, what does the Bible say, what does the message of Jesus, the message of the gospel say to us from that perspective. And what has happened when people have taken that seriously is that they usually have a direct critique of capitalism, of this need for redistribution, this separation between the wealthy and the poor, and the ways that economic power has been used to oppress people and has been used to really harm and keep people from full flourishing. And so many of the liberation theologies use communitarian ideas and Marxist formulations about what economies could look like, what our communities could look like. And so when we look at the Bible in light of the social situation of the margins, that's what many people come to. Many of these liberation theologians come to a need for change, a need for flipping the systems and making it possible for all people to flourish in a real, practical, physical way. And so this praxis, this expectation of concrete social change is really there. Not theoretical understandings of Jesus who rescues us only in a spiritual way, but the real idea that Jesus is a liberator of our physical, practical, social lives. And so we look to Jesus for not just spiritual liberation, but also practical liberation. So we have Gutierrez and from Peru, and Leonardo and Clodovis Bach from Brazil, speaking really clearly about the conditions that people were facing in Latin America at their time, and continue to experience primarily. So Gutierrez says, "I am firmly convinced that poverty, the subhuman condition in which the majority of humanity lives today, is more than a social issue. Poverty poses a major challenge to every Christian conscience and therefore to theology as well." And Boff said, "Liberation theology was born when faith confronted the injustice done to the poor. By poor, we do not really mean the poor individual who knocks on the door asking for alms. We mean a collective poor. The popular classes, the poor, are also the workers exploited by the capitalists, the underemployed, those pushed aside by the production process." So these are two of the folks who really defined what liberation theology meant in the 70s, primarily coming out of the 60s. So in the second General Conference of the Latin American Bishops in 1968 in Colombia, the Catholic bishops, a formal document was issued that stated that industrial capitalism enriched the developed West at the expense of the non-European poor through long-term exploitation of their labor and resources. And so these theologians were looking at the world around them and saw some things that were very clear to them that looked very similar to what was told about in the parables and what was told about in the prophetic texts. Landless farmers were picking crops under blistering sun for pennies. Foreign corporations mine and exploit precious resources. Wealthy oligarchies monopolize farmland for export crops, and popular organizations that protest injustice are violently repressed, and thousands of citizens were disappeared. So given that context, these folks were saying things have to change. This is not okay. And the Bible and our faith tells us that things should be different than this. Oops. So they created these base communities, partially from the encouragement by the Second Vatican Council that asked for the lay people to take a more active role in the church, and because there was this growing sense of distrust of the clericalism and the elitism of those who were leading the church. So they looked to that example from Acts of these early Christian communities where they shared things in common and studied together. So they did this, they studied together, applied the Bible to their own experiences, and really felt that there had to be a new way of seeing theology in the Bible, that it should be that Jesus is our liberator in these practical ways. And so this idea of the preferential option for the poor comes through, and it's important to look at that verb, the word optional, not as a noun, not as something that's optional, but as something that is a verb, so opting for the poor, so always opting for the poor when we're making considerations of what we should do. And so this as we saw throughout the Old and New Testaments, care for the poor is a theme. And these folks believe, and I join them in this belief, that the moral test of a society is how it treats its most vulnerable members. So we have to give special attention to those with special needs and those who are poor on the margins of society. And then as I mentioned, the Black liberation theology comes about the same time because it has its roots in the 1960s civil rights activism in the U.S., Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and develops its own kind of understanding of a theology that sees God concerned with poor and those who are weak. So James Cone wrote Black Theology and Black Power, he said, to set himself free from the bondage of white theology. He said, in the summer of 1968, I could no longer contain my rage. I was extremely angry with white churches and their theologians who were contending that black power was a sin of black pride and thus the opposite of the gospel. And I thought I had the quote here, but he also said that throughout his education, his college and graduate education, he had never read a book written by a black person, especially in his theology classes, right? And so he was hearing this as like saying that only white theologians knew the answer, and he said, I could no longer contain myself. I had to write something that came from my experience and that came from the experience of my community. And so Black Theology and Black Power was one of his first books. He also wrote a book called God of the Oppressed, which really goes into clear detail about his understanding of Jesus as black. To say Christ is black means that black people are God's poor people whom Christ has come to liberate. And then a more recent, I think he's not a theologian, but he studied theology, Dante Stewart wrote this book, Shouting in the Fire, an American Epistle, and he has a New York Times opinion that talks about his experience of the last several years of the murders that have become such public conversation, George Floyd and others. And he starts reading Cone, and he says, I saw why they were insisting on saying Jesus is black. They were not talking about his skin color during his earthly ministry, though it definitely wasn't white. They were talking about his experience, about how Jesus knows what it means to live in an occupied territory, knows what it means to be from an oppressed people. And so, as you might imagine, if you didn't already know this, James Cone got a lot of pushback for saying Jesus is black. There's a major challenge to interpret that for a lot of white communities, right? When they hear that, they resist it. And it's I think this quote from Dante Stewart is helpful in contextualizing it and reminding us what that means. But Cone was unapologetic when he said that, and he continued to say that his whole career. And I think it's really important that we have his witness of clearly and directly pointing out what was causing him so much difficulty and anger and how we need to change things. And so here's just one other piece of that. Christ comes into the world and takes on the quality of blackness along with all of the oppression that blackness carries with it, countering the sin of racism by becoming one who suffers from it. And black symbolically in the sense that he is present wherever there is human suffering. Dante Stewart also quotes this from Paradise, from Toni Morrison. Jesus had been freed from white religion, and he wanted these kids to know that they did not have to beg for respect. It was already in them, and they needed only to display it. So that, to me, gives that strong sense of if you move to saying Jesus is black, and you speak about that, what reverberations that could have for children in terms of their self-understandings, right? So it goes way beyond, kind of a social critical analysis comment to an understanding of what does that mean for people when they fully take in that Jesus is one of them and that Jesus is like them, that Jesus experienced the suffering and oppression that they might experience in their own life, and that they don't need to beg for respect, that it's in them, that they have the image of God in them just as much as anybody else, and so we need to honor that. But I thought that was a helpful connection. But James Cone makes some really clear, direct connections with the ideas of liberation theology around poverty specifically. So these are quotes from James Cone. The gospel is identical with the liberation of poor people from socio-political oppression. There can be no reconciliation with God unless the hungry are fed, the sick are healed, and justice is given to the poor. The justified person is at once the sanctified person, one who knows that his or her freedom is inseparable from the liberation of the weak and the helpless. And he quotes Gustavo Gutierrez in saying, the non-necessity of the present order, that what is not supposed to be. And we are required by that conviction to project a future social order wherein all can develop to their fullest potential. And so that's where I feel these Jubilee messages, these biblical messages calling us to imagine what is possible. What is possible for our community? And so I'm wondering, as you take in or further consider these liberation theologies, we've talked a little bit about this, but in the context of debt, in the context of wealth redistribution, in the context of a culture that tells us we need more and more and more every day, what is that Jubilee release, repair, and restoration feel like, given those comments? If you'd like to consider that, to take it in, to think for a second, what would release and repair feel like given those dynamics up there? What kinds of changes do we need in our healthcare system? Thinking aspirationally, not just small changes that would affect myself or my family. Thinking aspirational about Jubilee, big changes that could happen in those systems. What would that feel like? If anybody would like to speak up, you may feel free, or you may just sit with that question for a second. And then specifically, maybe I titled this Wallets and Workplaces, right? So the two places where I most come in contact with the economic systems is working for financial resources and every time I have to spend money on financial things. Do you have experiences with spending money, with thinking about budgeting that do align with your values? Has that been a place where you've had a good experience at some point? And with your workplaces, what kind of workplaces have we been a part of that really felt like they were aligned with our values? Has that happened for anybody? I'm guessing we have maybe more experiences that do not align. That's been more of my experience, unfortunately. But I'm going to share a few stories from communities of places where I think there are some potentials. And then we can maybe share with each other some stories we each have about workplaces and budgeting that's worked for us. So I want to talk a little bit about these topics. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with worker-owned co-ops. Maybe you have a co-op in your community. There's grocery store co-ops in a lot of communities now, but not everywhere. But these are two that I've been super inspired by in the Bay Area, the Arizmendi Collective and the Cheeseboard Collective. And they've been in operation since the 70s and pay their worker, they pay each other, they pay themselves a living wage with healthcare and retirement and benefits, operating bakeries in the Bay Area, a cheese shop and a bakery and a pizza bakery kind of place. But it's been incredible to see how successful they are and how they've managed to continue working together. And then the Cheeseboard Collective started in this in the 70s, I think, and then Arizmendi was kind of came after that, and now is a whole series of restaurants and bakeries and collectives with this model. And now they're starting a landscaping business and one other business that are built around this worker collective model. So what that shows me is it's possible to do workplaces differently, that there are ways to structure workplaces that keep everybody as employer owners and participating in the decisions of the business, but also sharing in the benefits of that business together. Anybody else have examples of cooperatives or collectives that you're familiar with? Yeah.
King Arthur Flour.
Oh, is that a cooperative too? Yeah, employee owned. Yeah, great.
In Minneapolis, there's the Seward Cafe, which is a similar vibe, I think, from about 2 years before Cheeseboard, but same model.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is possible. I feel like the argument that it's not possible has been refuted. It's maybe not easy or simple, but there have been ways that people found success in growing a business and keeping it on an equal playing field that everybody participates in decisions that are made and in the shared in the pay. So like when I worked in the Bay Area, they were offering pay of like $25 an hour, which was 10 years ago, right? So now I think it's quite higher than that. But at the time, that was an actual living wage. It wasn't extravagant. It wasn't wealthy, but it was an actual living wage in the Bay Area. So mutual aid efforts have sprung up a lot during the pandemic. I don't know if any of you have been involved in them. There's a huge amount of inspiring stories about what was accomplished by mutual aid, by people simply telling each other what they needed and finding ways to share the resources that they had. Even to the point in New York City and some other places where they were creating medical teams to do ambulance services for folks who were in need and couldn't access it for whatever reason, because they're too busy or because they just couldn't get connected through the difficult parts of the pandemic. So mutual aid has moved from there's a lot of food sharing for sure, but there was a lot of other kinds of resource sharing that popped up. And so now there's mutual aid communities in a lot of cities, and you can join them. In my city, they do a lot to support homeless folks and feeding the homeless encampments. But there is other ways that people have found actual mutual aid for supporting daily needs through these mutual aid communities and mutual aid efforts. So if you haven't known about them, you might look it up in your city when you go home or your town and see what kind of mutual aid resources are available and what kinds of things you could contribute to the mutual aid efforts in your community. And then we mentioned medical debt. So medical debt is a huge challenge for many people. But there is an organization that actually came out of the Occupy Wall Street movement that began doing debt forgiveness. And what they learned during some research is that you can buy medical debt a dollar for a hundred, right? Like, you can purchase other people's debt, because the debt collection agencies do this. They purchase debt from the hospitals or from whoever for like a dollar for every 100 that's needs to be collected, because there's, you know, the economics work so that it's difficult to do that, so you have to put in a lot of effort to recollect this debt. But you can buy the debt for a dollar, and then it pays off $100 of debt, right? Sorry, I'm not explaining this well. The video will do this better. Let me just say, you can participate in this too. So this organization has also taken that idea, recognizing that this was a predatory situation, right? That it just increased interest for some folks, and started buying up medical debt and making it possible for all of us to participate in that process. So this person has his story about medical debt and it being forgiven by this organization. Now I'll share this video so that you can hear the explanation more clearly.
Over 100 million Americans, or one in three, have struggled with the weight of medical debt, causing many to deplete their savings, turn to crowdfunding, declare bankruptcy, or worse, delay the medical care they need to stay alive. More than half of Americans say getting a bill they can't afford is as scary as a serious diagnosis itself. Our debt is killing us. But what if we could make that debt disappear? We're RIP Medical Debt, a nonprofit that has done just that, eliminating billions of dollars in debt for struggling Americans. We are working not only to shift the way we think about medical debt, but change the lives of people living in its shadow. So how do we abolish billions of dollars in debt without billions of dollars? By using the rules of the game, not to win, but to create a world where we take care of those who need it most. When you go to a doctor's office, hospital, or clinic, you might get a separate bill for every step of your care. If these bills aren't paid, they can be sold to a debt buyer for a fraction of what you owe. However, they will still attempt to collect the full amount owed from you. Some will add negative marks to your credit report, affecting your ability to buy a car or home, while others will even take legal action, resulting in wage garnishments and property liens. These actions used to leverage payment threaten the financial health of hardworking Americans who have this debt through no fault of their own. That's where we come in. RIP Medical Debt works with our partners to see through the chaos and find those debts that will be the most impactful when relieved. While we can search for a particular individual's debt, we can filter them down to make sure we're serving the people who are least able to pay. With our donor support, we're able to buy millions of dollars of debt at drastically reduced pricing, which makes this disappearing act one of monumental proportions. But we don't stop there. We make sure any negative marks on credit scores for the debt we buy are removed. So not only can recipients forget their past, but they can begin to move forward. Our programs put no additional tax burden on recipients and are compliant with HIPAA and the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And after all the behind-the-scenes work is done, every year we send out thousands of letters to homes all across the country, letting people know their past is in the past, their health is not a burden, and their life is worth more than a bill. And together, we'll cure medical debt.
So you can go to RIP Medical Debt. Maybe some of your communities have been involved in this. There's a lot of churches that actually have started doing campaigns like this. So you can see Wahoo First United Methodist Church in Nebraska has a current Jubilee campaign that they're working on, where they're trying to raise $15,000 to erase 150,000. Yeah, I think that's right. No, it's more than that.
No,
it's multiplied times 100. Yes, yeah. Multiplied times 100. So that's a lot of debt that they're able to do with their church community. There's also a Shemitah debt release campaign from a Jewish community that speaks about the Shemitah year. So you're free to contribute to these kinds of campaigns or to set up a campaign for your community or something else like that. To me, this is a real exciting thing. I don't know if you, there's been news of some bigger medical debt relief. Trinity UCC Church in Chicago did a huge gift of like millions of dollars, so bought tens and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of debt through a campaign that they did. So there's been some pretty big successes with this, and over time they've relieved a lot of debt. So to me, this is a Jubilee thing that we can participate in. It's not quite complete forgiveness, but like they said, using the rules of the game to kind of intercede and take that debt away from people instead of letting it just keep accumulating. Yeah.
Can you do it for specific people like in your community? You can't do that.
No, that's what they said. So the way they do this is by they try to filter it down to those who most cannot pay their debt. And they can find ways to kind of analyze that without actually HIPAA. It's HIPAA protected, so you can't find individual people's debt. But it, hopefully if more and more people take part in this, it will make a bigger impact on a lot of people.
I think it's the one thing I like about it is, like the crowdfunding thing is, if you have a good story, but if you just have a bad story,
right?
And so, and it doesn't matter what your race is,
right?
They don't filter for that, and so I think that's why it's just a more equanimity way of giving,
So many people have turned to crowdfunding for medical debt. I'm sure you've had seen this in stories in your community. I know one of my friends has a daughter who has severe kind of delayed developmental due to a genetic situation she has. And so she has to turn to crowdfunding, you know, to get a vehicle for her family that can use to transport her child, right? Because she has two good forms of insurance through city, county government and through a major employer in our region, and they still can't, they don't cover so many things. So it's really, demoralizing the whole healthcare world, but I hope that this is one way we can participate in, given the unjust system we currently have, here's one way we can intercede and take action to relieve some medical debt. And then this is a story that came to me several years ago. Circle of Hope is a church in Philadelphia, and they started this debt annihilation team because they realized that credit card debt was just so heavy on many of their members and people in their community. And so they offered this practical solution of coming together in these debt annihilation teams. They start with a seed fund that erases, pays off the highest interest debt in the group, but they do some calculations to figure out what the total debt in the group is, what people have been paying monthly. They pay off that first highest interest one, and then they start paying off the next highest interest by all contributing what they were paying to their own credit cards, right? So instead of me paying my own credit card every month and continuing to accumulate interest over time, I'm actually paying off debt quickly and therefore can be released from that debt. And so then once they've paid off everybody's debt, they commit to continuing to pay their monthly amount towards that seed fund to replenish that seed fund again. So they're actually doing pretty amazing things by bringing people together to annihilate simple credit card debt in their small teams. So I'll let Lauren speak a little bit more about this. So Lauren, I interviewed her about her experience as a coach.
I'm Lauren Smith. I am a coach with the Debt Annihilation Team at Circle of Hope. I've been doing it for about 6 years, though there have been a few hiatuses in there, and I'm involved with the group administration. But I think it definitely challenges like the general understanding of being a middle-class American, you know, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and taking care of your business and growing your financial wealth and all that, like expand your boundaries, take care of yourself, and the thought of even, you know, being transparent with someone else about how much you make and the debt you have and what you're doing about that and how you can, you know, be helped in that way or help someone else in that way is really uncomfortable for people at first. And I think that's, you know, just a nod to our Americanness and, you know, the capitalist, you know, tendencies and things. And it certainly messes with the credit card companies. I mean, they're terribly confused when somebody else is trying to pay off somebody else's debt. That is very weird to them. It really is a big leap of faith to jump in and do this with people that you know are committed to Circle of Hope, are committed to the church and, you know, loving Jesus and doing this together, but you're not committed to them personally yet, which is kind of one of the neat things that happens and one of the reasons that we have the monthly meetings that are face-to-face with the whole group is to build that bit of, like, group camaraderie. So that you get to know these people, and you know, if like 6 months in you're thinking like, I wish I could just bounce and stiff the group, you know, it's like at that point you're like, no, I like know these people, I care about them, I love them, they know me, you know. And so not saying that everybody comes in with the intentions of like, I'm gonna get the money and run, but you know, it adds an extra level of like humanity to the accountability, that it's not just an organization, it's this group of people that you've come to know and love. We have a covenant that all of our participants, or we call them annihilators, sign at the beginning. And so, you know, it's not a legal document, but it's still, you know, an acknowledgement of the agreements that we're going to have together. You're going to be honest about your finances. You're going to cease immediately using your credit cards. And you're not going to open any secret new ones. Like, this is the end of your credit usage. Which is a lot of times hard for people, because if they need money, then they have to ask to borrow it, which is awkward and painful and tricky, but like we want them to do that. Like, we have a fund specifically set up with our church, the Mutuality Fund. It's like, if you have a flat tire, if you have a roof leak, like, we will help you. We'd rather you come to us than the, you know, the credit card companies. And the agreement includes, you know, a monthly meeting with your coach, a monthly meeting with the whole group. I think those are largely the groups, the specifics of the covenant, you know, and then you'll just participate in an open and honest and, you know, trying to contribute positively to the group. So everybody signs that, and we're kind of off and rolling. You've got to, like, show your credit card statements so we can work out the financials, which for people is also really vulnerable, and in a lot of ways they've reported that that's quite embarrassing. We don't, like, broadcast them to the group. But you do have to share them with the financial, like the person doing the numbers, so we know who owes what and to who and all that. So yeah, there's a lot of layers of vulnerability that you kind of have to be willing to jump into at the beginning, just to get started. It definitely, you know, I know Jubilee to me has a huge connotation of like freedom and joy for the person being released from the debt. And so our, you know, I know that our annihilators are paying off their debt. But the jubilation that they feel when it is paid, you know, it's, even when all they owe is just the seed fund back to Circle of Hope, it just is a huge relief. Like, we've had people get that credit card balance zero, you know, and just like break down in tears because it just feels like something that has weighed them down. We have people who've acquired their debt as a result of divorce, as a result of medical issues, as a result of car accidents and those things that it's not that they just had too much fun and, you know, wrapped it all up in the credit card. Like, it's something that happened to them that felt insurmountable, and then as they were trying to heal from that, the debt on top of that provided an additional huge burden. And that was really meaningful. People have reflected that it was really meaningful that the community came alongside them. You know, in a lot of ways, in the original tragedy, in the divorce or the medical car accident, whatever happened. But then again, like 4 or 5 years in the making as they're trying to get out from underneath this financial burden. That's one of my favorite parts of coaching, is seeing people just feel like free. Like, they feel like they can stand up straight and think about, like, having a kid or buying a house or moving out of, you know, sharing with a roommate or just something that they've wanted to do that just requires money and they feel like they couldn't. If you hear the change in people, you know, nobody wants to talk about debt, but everyone wants to talk about how good it felt when they paid off their debt. You know, so at the beginning, people are like, yeah, I'm on the debt relation team. Like, they don't really want to say that they're part of the debt relation team. And then by the end of it, people are shouting. They're like, let me tell you about the debt relation team. Like, you have to do this. It's so wonderful. And, you know, so the change there in the attitude of, like, I don't really want to be vulnerable in this way. And then it's like, but look at, like, what this vulnerability provided, you know, the freedom and joy that they felt. And some people who were part of the team years ago, you know, still make small donations as, like, an homage to, like, I'm not paying a credit card debt and I never intend to again in my life. So I'll just send $10, everyone, you know, to the team to help support. You think it's...
So I've been super inspired by their program. They actually have all the resources on their website. If your church or community wants to find a way to do a debt annihilation team together, they've done the math. They figured out how to make this work and how to, you know, set up a seed fund and get people in the groups and do this. But I loved hearing about the layers of vulnerability and how challenging it is, which I think is real. It's also a sad part of our economic reality that, you know, talking honestly about what happens to us economically is so hard for us because we have this culture that kind of tries to put that behind a curtain and tries to make that your own business. And so I think they're really radically confronting that system by just talking publicly about it, even beyond the actual act of, you know, paying off the debts together. But she also talked about how the people by and large with the highest interest are women of color, single women of color. And so by putting people in these groups together, one of the math things they do is try to put people together, right? So I might have a 7% rate on my credit card debt that I need to pay off, and somebody else might have 24%, right? And so by putting us together in a group and getting that 24% debt paid off right away, less accumulation of interest, right? And so then there's actually a kind of an equalizing of the debt situation as well, which I think is also a justice thing. So I'm super inspired by that. I'm trying to figure out if there's ways to start debt annihilation teams because I know that so many, especially younger folks, are limited by their credit card debt from being able to do the next thing in life. So, I know it's past 10 and they rung the bell. I did want to offer, you know, family or community meetings as a way to check in. We talked about the exam and prayer yesterday as a way to kind of individually check in with yourself. I learned about community meetings when I lived in an intentional community where we lived together and shared a lot of our resources. So we had to have a community meeting every week to check in on a lot of things. And we're trying a little bit in our family to do family meetings from time to time. We have little kids, so it's a little bit harder. But there's these suggestions that, you know, starting with appreciations is a key. I want to just highlight that starting with appreciations in your community, in your partnership, in your group or your family can be a really important way to start any conversation. And then there's opportunities like for doing some discovery time together or, you know, ending with something fun. I put the asterisk there because those two are not the crucial pieces but could make it more of a fun thing. But doing a week in review, and so I'm suggesting for this conversation around, you know, values and commitments around budgeting to check in with your budget. But you can do it on any topic, right? Like check in on how things are going in your family. Doing some problem solving and then some weekly planning. But having that kind of commitment to regularly check in with each other, whether that's a partnership or a community group or a family, can be a way to check in with those values and commitments regularly and see where you're at and kind of recalibrate, which I think of as an important aspect of trying to live into these big and aspirational values. But I hope, I'm happy to stay here and chat more or answer questions, but hope you're inspired by the potential for doing some true debt relief in our communities, but also to think bigger about all the ways we can live into Jubilee in our economic systems. So thank you for coming and for chatting, and feel free to stay and chat.